Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back, Summer League Edition, Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck, both of us on the West Coast. I have just exited Summer League. Howard Beck is just entering Summer League. And you're not watching, obviously, but the look on our faces show that I've got the look of a man defeated by 5 days in Las Vegas. Howard has the look of a man eager to embrace his early days in Las Vegas. What up, Beck?
What's happening? Vegas is not going to defeat me, Mannix. It will wear my ass out. It's overstimulation. It's too much. It's overload. There'll be a lot of food and a lot of talking and a lot of schmoozing, but you will not find me in the places that are otherwise going to wreck me. I'm too old for that stuff.
You're never too old for Vegas. I mean, I love Vegas. I just need to take it in one less day every single year. So next year, I'll probably be like 3 days at Summer League. And then I'm
out. The good news is, if anybody was wondering about what the weather was like in Vegas, literally every single media person here has tweeted about it at least 17 times. Apparently, it's hot. So there you go, folks. There's your weather report for the day. Las Vegas, still hot in July.
Yeah, breaking news. Vegas, hot in July. Hasn't changed and never will. All right, let's talk about Vegas, Howard, and what's going on out there. Let's begin off the court, where the NBA Board of Governors is meeting this week and discussing a variety of different topics. Among the issues that's front and center is the play-in tournament. And it seems like, as we record this on Tuesday morning, that the NBA is prepared to codify the play-in tournament permanently into its calendar. That's really no surprise, Howard. The play-in tournament, you know, it has its detractors out there. There are the coaches that say, well, 82 games should be enough to decide who the top eight teams are in each conference. And I understand that point of view, but it also has done a credible job of curbing tanking, especially amongst those teams that are not quite ready to bottom out, but may have tried to bottom out if the play-in tournament didn't exist. And it's created a level of interest in the months of March and April in the end of the regular season. And as you know, as a longtime league observer, those can be dog days in the NBA calendar where teams in that 1-8 range, or at least the 7-8 range, are kind of playing out the string as they wait for the playoffs. So do you think it's a good move? What are your reaction to the NBA planning to cement the play-in tournament as a full-time part of the calendar?
Occasionally something happens and you go, oh, I thought that was already just the thing. I think this is one of those ones like, oh yeah, that's right. They did do it on a trial basis and then renewed it on a still trial basis. And now they're making it permanent. I just assumed it because everybody at the league level, and I think most people even at the team level, already embraced this and thought it was a great addition, great innovation, and paid off for all the reasons you just listed. Like, why wouldn't you keep it? And to the extent that there has been some pushback, and you're right, like there are still some people, coaches especially, who'd be like, oh, regular season, you want to make it as meaningful as possible, blah, 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 blah. Or, you know, Cuban kind of beefing about it in the first year of it. That's not the pervasive, most common view. And it's not like there was ever been a really big pushback to say, oh, we need to stop this before we make it permanent. Like, there's never been a counter push, really. People like it. It's been good for the league. It has generated interest. It does make that week of, you know, 4 days in a row of play-in games, while those games aren't necessarily always going to be great and they won't always involve teams that we want to see, it's going to generate another level of interest. And yes, it involves markets that otherwise would be on the outside already. And yes, those markets also had an investment in the final month of the season because their team still has something to play for. And those things matter. Those things matter. And to the idea that, like, well, the 82-game season should mean something, okay, fine. But if you finished 7th or 8th and are stuck in the play-in tournament, you weren't good enough to be 1 through 6, right? We will always have a cutoff point at somewhere to say, okay, fine. If you think you got cheated because you were better in the 82-game season than the 8th seed, well, then maybe you should have been another couple games better and been good enough to be the 6th seed and avoid the play-in, and so on down the line in the standings. So I don't have any sympathy for that particular point of view. The play-in has been an absolute win for the NBA. Making it permanent is a no-brainer.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. For all the reasons you laid out, it's exciting, it's compelling, it makes the first round or the quasi-first round, whatever you want to call what it is, more interesting, because usually these first-round matchups outside of like one or two aren't all that compelling. You're just kind of waiting to get to the second round. The play-in adds some excitement to those early days of the NBA playoffs. The other tournament that the NBA is trying to get over the finish line, and as we record this, I'm not sure they're going to be able to do it, is the in-season tournament. This has been Adam Silver's white whale for years now. He has been driven beyond words to add a in-season tournament for reasons I don't really completely grasp, Howard. I mean, I don't get the in-season tournament. I understand that January, February, those are tough days as too for the NBA. Interest isn't quite as strong after Christmas. But like a play-in tournament or in-season tournament, I just never saw the appeal to it. I mean, what are your thoughts on the in-season tournament? And why do you think Silver is so maniacally focused on getting this thing over the finish line?
Man, Adam's been talking about this since the day he became commissioner, like 8, 9 years
ago.
He
really has.
He's obsessed with European soccer. He wants to do everything they do. Maybe that could include guys flailing around, acting like they're injured, and then not really being injured and hopping right back up. Maybe we can do that too. He believes that one of the beauty, the part of the beauty of European soccer, and also I think the European basketball leagues do this too, is the idea that there are more than one thing to play for. That it's, you know, the NBA, we have one champion and then 29 losers, basically. And which is very American of us. And I think Adam likes the European idea that we can have more winners. There was more to have more things to play for. And I'm being, you know, slightly facetious with some of this. But that's the general idea. Adam has talked about it in those terms, that there needs to be more than one thing for teams to be able to lay claim to and to then energize fan bases around. It's fine in concept, but these cups that the EuroLeagues play for, whether in soccer or basketball, have been around for a long time. It's tradition. It's already embedded in the consciousness of sports fans there. It's not here. It's new here. And I don't know if or when people would actually really embrace it and get excited about, oh, they're playing for the David Stern Cup in February. I just don't know how or why that will
There's
ever
no
resonate.
Way. There's no way people get excited about that. There's just no way. It's
or November,
a
December,
meaningless,
whenever it's
a meaningless
be.
Title. It does. Right. There's no way people are getting into that
because you've manufactured it out of thin air. Because you know it's not the champion. Because you know it's like at most a line on basketball reference for the rest of time. But otherwise, it's kind of like, oh, okay, well, that was nice. All right, let's get back to the real thing. That's as soon as it's over, that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, there's no finality to winning the, let's call it the David Stern Cup for a moment. There's no finality to winning the David Stern Cup.
It's going to be the David Stern Cup.
The next night, like the David Stern Cup champion Warriors will turn around and play like the Wizards in Washington. Like it does.
Yes.
It's just
and lose because they'll be tired from the David Stern Cup.
And lose, exactly. Like it'll be a come down from. Well, they're trying to make it Howard financially palatable right now to players. There's talk of a $1 million per player bonus, which is where you need to start to get a sign off from the union. There's also been talk about reducing the regular season from 82 to 78 games. All this seems like a lot of work for an inconsequential event. That's kind of my big takeaway from it.
And that's the thing. So you can incentivize teams through financial inducements. You can incentivize the players through financial inducements. You can make it palatable enough to get buy-in from the constituencies that need to buy in. Fine. Okay. You will have created the tournament. Congratulations. You will have induced them. And that's the only thing that's inducing anybody, by the way, of course, is the money. Because why else would anybody really care to do it? Other than this leap of faith that Adam wants them all to make, that this will somehow benefit the league and these teams on some broader basis. It will increase interest. It will help stoke interest in the early parts of the season when maybe fans aren't fully engaged yet because they're waiting for the playoffs, right? But that's a leap of faith, Chris. That's not a given that that's actually going to generate more goodwill, more interest, more engagement for the league as a whole. So the only way that owners and players are going to buy in is through these financial inducements. Okay, fine. So now you'll have it. Then what? You still have to market it and actually get the public and us in the media to buy in. And I think we are all largely overwhelmingly skeptical. And that being the case, they're pushing this thing uphill. Adam has revived this on about an every other year basis. It gets to a vote or it gets to a board of governors discussion. It dies. Stories are written. A couple years later, it's leaked again that Adam Silver is making a new push for the midseason tournament. People talk about it. It goes to Board of Governors. It dies again. And that's it. We're just stuck in this cycle for the last decade.
Yeah, we are. As long as Adam Silver is commissioner, I don't expect that to change. I think every couple of years he will continue to advocate for this, maybe find a new wrinkle that makes owners more interested. But right now, it just seems like when it comes to tournaments, the play-in tournament is where owners justifiably are fixated. It creates revenue, it creates interest, and at this point, there's been no model I've seen that shows that the in-season tournament does any of that. All right, let's talk about on the court at Summer League. I know you're just getting there and you're eager to get out there and watch yourself some Chet Holmgren and Paolo Banchero and Jabari Smith and all the other fledgling NBA players.
Paolo's already been shut down.
Has he been shut down for good? I know he didn't play on Monday night, but
they've pulled the plug. That they've seen enough. Good luck with this one, NBA, by the way, too. If this is the new trend now, too, the top stars come in, the top lottery picks come in, play a couple of games, and then check out. Adam's got bigger things to worry about than the midseason tournament.
The absurdity of that is wild. We're going to shut down our 20-year-old rookie because maybe he might be tired. He might get injured, or we want to get a better look at some other guys that will never make our training camp roster. Just let these guys play for the duration of the summer league. Then you can shut them down for 2 months after before you get into official training camp. But Chet Holmgren has become kind of the talk of first the Salt Lake Summer League and now Summer League in Las Vegas. When I look at these rookies, Howard, and I saw Chet in Salt Lake City, I saw Paolo and I saw Jabari play in Vegas. Paolo, to me, is the most NBA ready. I mean, he's physically strong. He's an excellent passer already at this stage. I think he's going to be, or he will be, the favorite to win Rookie of the Year. Jabari Smith, pretty big upside as a two-way player. Great length, great athleticism. The knock on him was he wasn't all that assertive or needed to be more assertive in college. I can see a little bit of that in the pros, but while it may take him time, I think he just turned 19. I think he's got a pretty high ceiling as a two-way player. The highest ceiling, though, is Chet. It's also the highest risk and maybe the lowest floor for what NBA player at that level is going to be. When I watch him play, skills are obvious. He can take the ball off the glass. He can initiate a fast break. The number of centers in today's NBA, Howard, that can do that, it's one, really. It's Nikola Jokic out in Denver. So if Chet can be that kind of guy, he can really make your offense dynamic. The three-point shot is already there. It's only going to get better. But the strength is an issue. He is the skinniest NBA player I've ever seen, at least the skinniest since Manute Bol back in the day. He is skinnier than Kevin Durant was as a rookie. He is skinnier than Giannis Antetokounmpo was as a rookie. He is rail thin. And I watch him, and I wonder, how much stronger is he going to get? How much stronger does he need to get to be effective at an NBA level? I had one coach during the Salt Lake Summer League tell me that, look, the skills are obviously there. He's making three-point shots, 4 of 6 in his opener. But the reason he was taking those shots is because he doesn't have the strength to get around guys. Those are summer league guys. He doesn't have the strength to get around. So he's probably going to have to make or take and make a lot of tough shots to produce early on at the NBA level. Now, Oklahoma City's incredibly smart. Like, they're aware of this. Like, and Sam Presti, high draft picks, he often doesn't miss, right? He drafted Durant. You can say that was a no-brainer at number two, but then he drafted Russell Westbrook. That was not a no-brainer. That was criticized at the time. Drafted James Harden. That was not a no-brainer. So he's got an eye for talent at the top of the draft. And you know, I've talked to other executives that say they would have taken Chet number one if he had been there as well. So the upside is definitely there, but I just wonder how concerned we need to be about his strength level and what it needs to get to in order for him to be an all-star, all-NBA level big man.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to adjust our discussion of the skinny guys to, on some level, given the era we're in, right? Like, this isn't the era of Shaq and Patrick Ewing and Hakeem Olajuwon, and, you know, big men play differently now. Unless you're out there guarding Joel Embiid or Jokic. And even then, like, I mean, yeah, Jokic works in the post some too. But I mean, there's not a lot of bigs that you have to worry about banging on or banging on you. So like that part of it, we should throw out the window, right? We can't talk about the game as if this is the 90s.
But before I let you go, continue there, but I would push back a little bit because, like, I mean, you're right. Ewing, Olajuwon, Shaq, they're not there. But Steven Adams, big, burly. DeAndre Ayton, big, burly. Like,
okay,
these are big men.
How often are you having to bang with Steven Adams in the post because they're dumping it into him? Like, we don't have dump it into the center offense for the most part in today's NBA.
No, I guess where I should have mentioned this during my what I was saying there, but like when I watched Chet in Utah, you know, guys like Taco Fall and Kofi Cockburn were able to wrestle with him in the paint and push him around to a degree in the paint. And this is why I don't think Chet, like, ultimately, I don't know who the five would be in Oklahoma City. I'm kind of blanking on their roster at the moment. But, like, Chet's probably going to have to be a four, which presents another set of problems because if you're guarding a quicker four on the perimeter, can he stay with them on the outside?
Yes, and I do think, so just to you know, continue the thought on this, like, it's not, Chris, that I'm saying that there's no importance to strength, to a big man having to being able to hold guys off and everything. It's not that there's no, it's a different version of it than in the past. And the thing you do still have to do, you do have to be able to fight for rebounds. You do have to be able to score through traffic. You do have to be able to just survive. There is going to be, if not a 90s style beating, there is still some beating that you take when you get into the paint in the NBA, no matter whether you're guard, center, forward, whatever. But yeah, like it's gonna matter. I'm looking at the roster. There really aren't any traditional bigs there, unless I don't know how much Derek Favors still playing like some center for them. But like they don't. There may be Chet Holmgren at center by default. I think that the other problem here is that we're trying to project too much based on a guy who's still only a couple months removed from college, who's playing in the summer league, where people are going to react to summer league. People need to stop reacting to summer league as if it's an NBA game. These are not NBA games. These are a collection of rookies and free agents and undrafted guys and fringe players, most of whom will never play in the NBA, who have been thrown together, had a couple of practices, and are going out and playing pickup. Whatever you see, good, bad, or otherwise, It's not that you can't look at Paolo Banchero and go, oh man, dude can really pass. Yeah, he can pass. He can pass at Summer League. He can pass when he's a Duke. He's going to be able to pass for real games for the Orlando Magic. But whatever Paolo Banchero does really well here in Vegas, or is no longer doing because they've already shut him down for the Summer League, it's not the same as when you get on the court in October against real NBA competition, against guys who are all big and fast and athletic and have an organized defense and have been playing together for a while. It is a completely different thing. So if you want to hone in on any one guy's skill set and say what they did well or did not do well and how quickly they made decisions with the ball in their hands and all these other things, all the basic scouting stuff is fine, but drawing conclusions on any of these guys based on Summer League is just stupid. It just is. It's profoundly stupid. This is a pickup league where guys just got together. Most of them will not be in the NBA. The NBA is harder. And all you have to do is all you have to do is look at the list of guys who have been MVP of Summer League in years past. And by the way, the fact that they've now created championship rings for Summer League is just like, talk about the participation trophy thing. Like, I'm not usually one to go down the participation trophy lane, but between the midseason tournament that Adam wants because he wants people to win more championships or more titles and having rings for Summer League, like, it's fine. Like, I don't care. If guys get the ring and they like it and they're proud of it, that's fine. But oh my gosh, like, Summer League is meaningless, largely meaningless.
I can't wait to see those assistant coaches on the bench next year and years to come wearing those Summer League championship rings.
They're not going to be wearing
come
those
on,
rings ever.
Rocking them.
No, they got to wear them. They should be required to wear them at the next Summer League, walking around like, hey, yeah, remember us, Summer League champs 2022.
I'm the champ. I'm the champ doing interviews there. All right. Couple things happened since we last recorded this podcast, Howard. Two big contracts were signed in the NBA. Bradley Beal got himself a new deal with the Washington Wizards, 5 years, $251 million. Also got a no-trade clause in that deal, making him the only current NBA player and one of only a handful of NBA players historically that have ever received a no-trade clause. He gets one from the Wizards. And Damian Lillard, he gets a two-year extension on his deal with Portland. He had 3 years remaining already. They tacked two more on. It makes Lillard, the value of Lillard's deal, well north of $200 million. His career earnings, guaranteed, will now be north of $450 million. So good for Damian Lillard for locking that up. But of those two contracts, what was the most eye-opening one for you? Which one took you aback the most?
Definitely Beal's, because they gave him a no-trade clause. And everybody has had time to process this over the last week, where the list of everybody else who's ever had a no-trade clause, the other nine guys, I think it was, in NBA history, are all Hall of Famers or future Hall of Famers. And Bradley Beal, while a very good player, is not. I get wanting to reward a guy for loyalty. I get wanting to reward the guy who's your franchise star, who has stuck with you through thick and thin. By the way, mostly thin. And you're rewarding him, but you're already rewarding him financially. You're already giving him another max deal when on his own he has not, and even when he's had John Wall healthy next to him, he has not been able to lead you anywhere. So you're already paying him at a level that, okay, yes, this is the standard in today's NBA. All players who are all-stars or even occasional all-stars, but if they're your best player, you're going to pay them the max. And when they're eligible for an extension, they're going to get a max extension. It's just kind of automatic. It's just today's NBA. Everybody who is a star for their team gets the max extension. When they're up, they're going to get it again as long as they stay loyal to the franchise. I don't know how to judge that one way or the other. I think it makes a bit of sense, and it certainly is good good relations with your player and with his agent and with players in general who see that you always reward your guys, and maybe that pays off down the line. You're not trying to be cheap with them or alienate them. Like, I get it. There's a bunch of other stuff that goes into play here, but it's a lot of money to tie up in a guy. We should even think of it in money terms, by the way, too. Like, I don't care what guys are making. It's the fact that it's a massive percentage of a team's salary cap, and it then limits what else they can do in a salary cap system. So the Blazers and the Wizards each have a star who has been really important to their franchise. Lillard's case, the most important player in franchise history. In Beal's case, just been very good for this era. But in both cases, you've got guys who are, you know, later stages of their careers. Beal's still in his prime. Lillard is kind of, early 30s now. coming, they're both coming off of injuries. And if you over invest in those guys, you have limited what else you can do with your roster for several years to come. That's the question. It's not like, oh, I can't believe he's making $50 million a year. Who cares? It's what they do to limit their flexibility under the salary cap. That's the problem it poses. And the limitations then on if things are not going well, being able to pivot and take a new direction. And if a guy's got a new trade, a no trade clause, guess what? It's really hard to pivot and change direction. So that's the issue here. It's not what they make. It's the way it hems you in as a team. And I get it more from Portland's standpoint because of Lillard's importance to that franchise than I do from the Washington one.
Yeah. Well, let me say on the Beal thing quickly, and we'll circle back to Beal in a minute. But I was less... Yeah, like there's been a lot of consternation about the no trade clause. It just feels to me like every star player has a no trade clause because you're not going to surrender real assets to get a star player unless that star player wants to be there. Like, to me, it's as simple as that. Like Kevin Durant, who we're going to talk about later on. You know, like a team's not going to acquire Kevin Durant unless he kind of gives the okay because, you know, Phoenix is not moving DeAndre Ayton and Mikal Bridges for Durant unless Durant wants to be there. Boston isn't shipping Jaylen Brown out unless Durant wants to be there. Like, nobody wants the headache of a star player that doesn't want to be there. So the no-trade clause, while, you know, rare, certainly, and surprising to be given to a player like Bradley Beal, that didn't move me all that much. The Lillard extension didn't surprise me, but it was probably more eye-opening for me because Washington had to pay Bradley Beal. He was a free agent. You don't pay him, he's gone. Portland didn't have to pay Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard got these extra 2 years despite having 3 years remaining on his contract. He's also coming off the fewest games played in his career, dealing with the first major injury of his career. So, like, I understand you want to reward a player like Damian Lillard, what he's done for that franchise, everything you said. Dame is a tremendous guy and a tremendous player and a great ambassador for that franchise. Someone who, by the way, I truly believe when he says, I want to win in Portland. I always believe that when guys say they want to win in City X. I believe Damian Lillard truly wants to win in Portland. He's like Giannis in that sense. But what was the urgency to do that deal? Like, you know, don't you want to wait? Maybe wait a year to see how he bounces back from this injury? Maybe wait and see how kind of your new signings of Jeremy Grant and, you know, with Lillard playing next to Anthony Simons full-time for a year. Like, maybe see how all those things kind of shake out before you do a deal. Again, I wasn't surprised that Portland did this. Like, they want to lock in Damian Lillard long-term, nor do I begrudge Damian Lillard for getting paid like that because he's meant so much to that city, that organization, everything about it. It just, you know, it was a deal they didn't have to do. And, you know, I wonder if in 2 years they regret doing it and say, look, now we have Lillard. He's still a good player, but he's not great anymore, and he's making like $60 million on the back end of that deal. That was my only question when it came to the Lillard deal.
Yeah, I mean, but this goes back to what I was saying in the beginning, which is that teams are now operating not on what makes the most sense, what is this guy's value, you know, where you can do this, right? You've got analytics that can tell you what a guy's actual value is in this system, right? They're not trying to reward guys based on what their actual value is. They're not trying to reward them based even on what they've already done sometimes or what you think they're going to do throughout the course of the contract. You're doing it based more on this idea that we have to reward our best player. We have to reward our franchise star. We have to reward, in Lillard's case, the best player in franchise history. We have to reward a guy who's been loyal to us despite the fact that at times we have been all over the map, flopping around like a fish out of water, not sure what the hell to do with our roster, right? Like, both of these teams have been flailing in recent years and unable to pick a direction, unable to make good decisions, unable to get the right guys around their stars. And so on the back end of it, you're like, well, the guy wants to stay anyway. What choice do we have but to just keep doing this? And it makes some sense. It's keeping faith with the star. It's keeping faith with your fans who are rooting for that star. Again, especially in Lillard's case. I don't know that Beal, this is a hard thing to judge, so I'm just talking off the top of my head here. But I got to believe that Damian Lillard has much more resonance and importance to the fans of the Trailblazers than Beal does to the Wizards.
100%.
Right? So if they parted ways with him tomorrow, if they said, we just can't come to terms on a new deal, or we've decided to do a sign and trade, or we've just decided to go a different direction, or we're not going to give him the max and he's mad about it now, so he may want to leave. You can afford to do that as the Wizards because Beal does not mean as much to that organization as Lillard does to the Blazers comparatively. So where is the real urgency to go down this road? I think it's just to basically say, well, this is our guy. It's the guy we have. We don't have another guy. We don't know how we're going to get the next guy. And we're also afraid that if we alienate this guy and it looks bad, then it's going to be harder to get the next guy. And so I think teams do this out of a feeling of optics and obligation as opposed to what's the best path competitively. And okay, all of it matters. It's still a business that you got to run. You have tickets to sell and fans to keep happy. And Beal will keep you at a certain floor. But you still have the job made harder by the fact that he's got this big contract of trying to surround him with talent that's good enough to get you somewhere. And neither of these teams, Chris, are going anywhere this season. Neither of them. They'll each be lucky just to be in the play-in. And so at the end of it, you wonder, well, then what's the point? You know? So it's dicey.
Yeah, and look, I think Lillard became much more complicated to trade if you do want to ultimately go in that direction, because now you're talking about a 32-year-old player on a 5-year deal as opposed to a 32-year-old player on a 3-year deal. A guy on a 3-year deal, you can get a lot back in return for him at that age. 5 years, look, if Lillard bounced back this year and plays brilliantly as an all-star once again, all-NBA once again, it's a different discussion. But, you know, if he does not regain that form, and look, he's played a lot of basketball, a lot of miles on him, because he's been an Iron Man for that team for most of his career, to his credit. But it complicates the situation even further. And I don't know if that situation needed to be complicated at this point in time, not with 3 years remaining on that contract. I want to talk about Lillard and Beal, but I want to weave it into a discussion we're going to have here about Kevin Durant. All quiet at this point on the Kevin Durant front. I spent most of All-Star Weekend kind of chatting with executives about where the Durant conversation was going, and nobody seems to believe there's any urgency at this point from Brooklyn. They've made it clear what their asking price is going to be, as I've reported and others have. 2 All-Star level players, multiple draft picks. They want the biggest return in NBA trade history in exchange for Kevin Durant, and I understand it. He's a All-NBA, MVP-level talent with 4 years remaining on his contract. But he is a player with 4 years remaining on his contract who has asked out of a situation he agreed to just a year ago. Now, Draymond Green said something about the criticism of Kevin Durant on his podcast. Take a listen to what Draymond said.
If Kevin Durant says, I actually don't want to be here anymore, I want to go to somewhere else, why does it matter? Why does that make you weak? Why does that make him, you know, it means he's running from something? I don't understand that. And so why is it that it's just not, that's the next step in his career? Because again, I always go back to, if someone leaves Google to go to Apple after 3 or 4 years, and then they leave Apple after 2 years to go to Tesla. And then they leave Tesla after 4 years to go to DocuSign. No one's going to say that person ran, or that person did this, or that person did that. Everyone's going to say that person did what was best for their career and best for their livelihoods. But us as athletes, it's never viewed that way. Why can't you do everything you can to get it right? Even if that means making a wrong move and continuing on, why is it that athletes are viewed that way?
Now, Howard, I don't think Kevin Durant is soft. I don't think Kevin Durant is weak for requesting a trade. I think he sees the writing on the wall in Brooklyn and is trying to find more championship-friendly surroundings. And I think he's doing it in a climate and a NBA landscape that is allowing him to do it. And I wrote a little bit about this over at SI.com on Tuesday. This is becoming something of a developing problem for the NBA, where you've got stars with multiple years left on their contract saying, I want out. You had James Harden back in 2020, before the start of the COVID-shortened season, saying, I don't want to be in Houston anymore. Then he sort of sleepwalked through eight games with the Rockets, eventually got traded. Ben Simmons, he had 4 years left on his contract with the Sixers when he went to them and said, I think it's time for a change of scenery. Similarly, Durant has not played a minute for the Nets on this new deal, the one he agreed to, the four-year, $198 million extension with the Nets that he agreed to last fall. He's saying he wants out. Now, I have some thoughts on this, but I want to hand it over to you first. Like, how big a problem do you think this is for the NBA? Well, you've got stars with multiple years, sometimes as many as 4 years left in their contract, asking out, and ultimately, as we saw with Simmons, as we saw with Harden, and as we're probably going to see with Durant, getting what they want.
It's not a developing problem. It's a problem. I mean, it's this has been going on now and picking up steam for the last 5 years, basically. It used to be that if a guy asked out, it was with a year left on their deal. It was the Paul George in Indiana model. Paul George goes to the Pacers and says, guys, I got a year left, and I'm not resigning. I'm going to walk away. So before you lose me for nothing, you might
as
well trade.
Which, Howard, like, you're on the right, I think you're on the right path. Like, that's even different. Like, that's, I almost think that's like doing them a favor there.
Yes,
like, if you're doing the team a favor saying, look, I'm not going to come back, so if I won't say anything, but like, you know, you might as well get rid of me and get something back in return.
Yeah, it's an approach that benefits both parties. Even if the Pacers didn't want to lose him ultimately, even if Pacer fans are upset by him wanting to leave, the fact is, it's kind of the classy way to do it, right? And it's with a year left, so that's a fair time to say, not just to use your leverage of free agency, but to say this is an opportunity for both sides to get something out of it. Great. That was the old model. That was also the model Anthony Davis used to leverage his way out of New Orleans. And it's the model that a lot of guys have used over the years. What we have recently is Ben Simmons with multiple years and now Kevin Durant with multiple years. It actually started with Kyrie. Kyrie back in Cleveland had 2 years left at a time when some guys had forced their way out with one. Kyrie had 2 years left and forced his way out of Cleveland in 2017, I think it was.
Yeah.
So, and now it doesn't matter. Now contracts are almost irrelevant. The length of the contract, irrelevant. That's never been the case in the course of NBA history. Not like this. And there are more stars forcing their way out more often in the last 5 years than in all of NBA history. So when Adam says, and the league loves to do this, oh, well, you know, you guys forget back in, you know, the 1970s and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar forced his way from Milwaukee to LA. Yeah, yeah, that was the exception and not the rule back then. Now it's the rule. Now it's all the time. And the way I've framed it, the word I always use is destabilizing. It's destabilizing for the league. It's destabilizing for these markets. It's destabilizing for competitive balance. Teams do what they can to scout and draft and develop and do everything possible. And then one day a guy, even on teams that are competitive, right? Like if you want to say, well, if a team, you know, screwing up and the guy wants out because he's frustrated, he should be able to go even if he has multiple years left. Okay, maybe, but one, you signed the long-term deal. You could have just signed year to year. Guys can do that now, by the way. In the past, in previous eras, guys would not sign year to year because they didn't make enough money to be set up for life. A guy could sign a one-year deal now and be set up for generations based on one-year, $20, $25 million contract. So they don't need the long-term security. If they want ultimate optionality, they have the they can sign one-year deals or one-plus-one deals. They don't have to sign long-term. But the other thing is that guys are forcing their way off of good teams now, right? Harden, the Rockets weren't going to be terrible. They just weren't going to be good enough for Harden's taste, so he forced his way out. The Nets weren't terrible. He just didn't like the environment, so he forced his way out again. Kyrie forced his way out of a team that had made three straight finals in Cleveland. So you can't even say it's that the players are justified. I mean, everything is justified in the sense that everybody has the right to have their own career path. And to Draymond's point, there's a little bit of straw man going on here. I understand that there are some fans and probably some media who still do this thing where players should just stay put and they shouldn't. This is not the Google Apple DocuSign analogy that Draymond was talking about.
Yeah.
When if you're a free agent and you leave, you know, if you're a Google free agent and you leave for Apple, that's the analogy if you are Kevin Durant in 2016 leaving the Thunder for the Warriors, not the Kevin Durant who has just signed a new four-year deal with the Nets and is trying to now force his way out. I think most people in this era have come to fans and media have come to terms with the idea that when players want to move, they're going to move. And in free agency, all is fair. But when you've signed a contract and the team now has an expectation that this is who we are building around for the next few years, when the fans have run out and bought their jersey, and so this is the guy I'm rooting for now, this guy represents my team, there is a reasonable expectation that a guy is going to stay put. This is not the Google Apple DocuSign analogy. And besides that, players, because of the money they make, the trade-off is you give up a little bit of your optionality in your career for a short period of time. And the payoff for that is you are fabulously wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like celebrities giving up some of their privacy. Like, it's not great. It's a shitty part of celebrity, but it's kind of the bargain that you buy into in certain fields. And this is one of them. So, like, I respect where Draymond's coming from, but there's a little bit of straw man to this. And, you know, by the way, last quick thought on this before I throw it back to you. He doesn't like Kevin Durant being criticized for wanting out and people saying he's soft and all that. And that's, you know, the soft stuff is stupid anyway if people are saying that. But the fact is we don't know why Kevin Durant is asking out exactly because he hasn't said it. So as long as Kevin Durant is going to make a trade demand without, you know, providing any other information, and he's got all the avenues in the world, his own podcast, his own, you know, media company, everything. If you leave us, the public, in the dark, you leave things to chance as to what we're going to interpret about your decision.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I got some pushback even from internally from our editors, like when I was writing my story about this, where, you know, I was getting texts and emails about, well, teams can trade a player at any time. Like, but that's not the equivalent there. I mean, a team cannot stop paying a player. Like, a player signs a contract. Right. Whatever franchise he is with, he is going to get paid every nickel of that contract, sometimes more, because a lot of these guys have trade kickers in their deal that gets them even more money if they wind up being traded. So an NBA owner cannot say, I'm going to not pay you. So that to me is not the equivalent of a player demanding a trade, a team trading a player. Now, Howard, you and I have covered many labor negotiations over the years. Oftentimes, the league will look to the collective bargaining agreement for solutions like this. Back in 2005, the NBA fought to reduce the number of guaranteed years down from 7 to 6, or 7 to 5, I think they wanted. They eventually got 6 or 4, whatever it was. They got 6. 2011, they they were looking for, I believe, what, 4 years for the, or 5 years for the guaranteed contract, 6 years if you sign with your own team. In the most recent round of negotiations, they got 4 years if you go somewhere else, 5 years. So they've been slowly whittling down the number of years on that contract. But as we look ahead to the current collective bargaining negotiations, there really is no solution to this right now. Nothing you can find, at least not in the collective bargaining grid. Because players, first of all, as recently as a few years ago, they started signing short-term contracts anyway, at least the guys at the highest level. I mean, LeBron James signed 2 straight when he went back to Cleveland. Kevin Durant signed 3 straight with Golden State. So, you know, some of the top guys are only signing really short-term contracts. And what we're just talking about, more recently, guys are signing those long-term deals and saying, you know what, I don't want to be here anymore, and kind of bullying their teams into trading them. So I don't think there's a solution to this problem in the collective bargaining agreement. It was suggested to me that one thing owners could push for is in max deals, there is a provision that says a player cannot be traded during the first 3 years of that contract. But that also limits the options of a team that may want to offload the contract anyway. So that's there's a little bit of risk for both sides involved in that. But that's something maybe to keep your eye on as we kind of move this forward. But what this comes down to is owners, what do we say? Do we swear much in this podcast? Owners having some balls out there. I mean, like, just saying, like, no, we're not. You signed the contract. We still want you here. We're not going to make a deal for you. You're going to play. And if you don't want to play, get a house next to Ben Simmons' place in Philadelphia and post up out there. Like, it was like a lot of teams, you know, there was some envy even from some of the executives I talked to about how Daryl Morey handled the situation with Ben Simmons in Philadelphia. He eventually did trade him, but that's because Daryl got the guy he wanted. He wanted James Harden all along. He eventually got him. But Daryl was willing to be uncomfortable there, and he was willing to, in a big market town, deal with the drama of Ben Simmons week after week, month after month, and not cave to a trade demand for a player as valuable as Simmons under as long a term a contract as Simmons. I had some executives say to me, like, look, we could never do that. Our owner wouldn't support that. You need to have ownership backing to take that kind of position. Owners need to step up and curb this themselves if they want it to stop, because, you know, I don't know if the Nets are going to hold that line in the sand on what they want for Durant, but they may decide come August that, you know, look, we don't want to go into training camp like this. We don't want to be uncomfortable. We'll trade Durant for 75 cents on the dollar instead. And I know a lot of teams out there rooting against that. They want to see the Nets say to Durant, you know, go and play. Somebody brought up to me the analogy of Aaron Rodgers in the NFL. Remember, last year, Aaron Rodgers said, I don't want to be in Green Bay anymore. I want to trade. The Packers, they said, go fly a kite. Well, Aaron Rodgers came back. He was the MVP last season. The Packers went 13-4. And just a few months ago, Aaron Rodgers signed a long-term extension to stay in Green Bay. So it's a different sport, but I've talked to enough people that say, like, look, you could have a similar result. You know, Durant's not happy now. If you don't get exactly what you want, don't deal him. Bring him to training camp and then kind of dare him not to play at the highest level. And you and I have discussed this before. There's no way Durant dogs it. There's no way Durant sits out. He's Kevin Durant. He's one of the most competitive guys either one of us has ever covered. He's going to play at the highest of level. And you know, unless you get exactly what you're looking for, there may not be an alternative better than that.
Yeah, listen, big problem among NBA franchises that I've noticed over the decades. There are just a lot of franchises that don't have the strength of their convictions. Some of them just don't even have convictions. They don't know what they're doing. They're just flailing around. And so as a result, you don't have any guiding philosophy for situations like this. I said, as you know, I said it at the time, in real time, Daryl Morey was making the right decision on Ben Simmons. He was right to hold out for the right deal. He was right to hold the line. People were saying, oh, you're going to waste a season of Joel Embiid's career and Ben Simmons isn't playing and all this. It was the right thing to do. It was the right thing because otherwise he would have been trading him for less than what he thought he should get for him. And the same applies to the Nets. And if and when you I bring up the strength of convictions thing, because you just said you talked to front office guys who's saying, well, our owner would have never supported that. That's the problem. That's the problem, is that they just don't have the stomach for it. And listen, if Kevin Durant wants out, fine. Like, maybe the relationship is over. Just maybe it is time to move on. But if you can't get the deal you want, he does have a contract. That contract pays him very well. He does love to play basketball. And I don't think he's going to sit out a season the way that Ben Simmons did. I'm not saying, like, call the bluff just for the sake of calling the bluff. But if you don't have the deal that you want and that you think you can still get, then don't do it. Don't trade him just to trade him. Don't trade him. No one should ever trade a guy just to alleviate the headache, right? Do it because it's the best deal at the best time for the long-term health of your franchise. Don't do it out of desperation. Don't do it under duress. Don't do it just because, okay, now I can exhale and I've done this. Not if the deal sucks. And so, like, that's the point. That is the whole equation here. So Sean Marks, I think, is doing the right thing, if that's in fact what is happening here. It hasn't really been that long since this all unfolded. But if the deal's not there, wait for the deal to be there. And in the meantime, maybe Kevin Durant changes his mind. It happens. It can happen. And, you know, he does have an obligation. He did sign the contract. And if he doesn't show up, he does lose money. And also, in Kevin Durant's case, I mean, he doesn't need the money, but he loves basketball. He's not going to want to do that. Kobe Bryant, again, famously, once upon a time, had a total meltdown and demanded a trade, and then eventually calmed down and decided he would stay put after all. Different situation, but the bottom line is, guys can change their minds. What looks like the you know, darkest possible timeline can alter, and you know, maybe Durant, over the course of the next couple of months, we got a lot of time left before training camp opens. A lot of time. Maybe he decides, you know what, fine. I think I could see a future with me, Ben Simmons, Seth Curry, Joe Harris, Nick Claxton, and whoever they've gotten for Kyrie, because by that time I think they'll have traded him. Like, the idea that Kevin Durant can be traded somewhere else and immediately have a better situation than the Nets, I don't know that that's, like, he might not. So, again, what is really driving him? Where is he hoping to go, and for what purpose? Is it just about winning championships? Is it just that he doesn't like the way that Brooklyn has handled things, which he and Kyrie have a lot of responsibility for? Until we understand what his motivation is, it's going to be hard to know whether or not it's possible to pull this thing back from the ledge.
Yeah, you're right. And it might be months before we see a resolution of that. Now, let me finish, Howard, with the obligatory Lakers reference here, because there was quite the scene at Summer League over the weekend. You had LeBron James at the Lakers Summer League game. You had Russell Westbrook at the Lakers Summer League game. As far as we could tell in the media, the two of them didn't interact. That's a long way, Howard, from last year, where there were those Instagram photos of LeBron and Russ working out and LeBron posting that, you know, count us out if you must. I'm sort of paraphrasing there, but don't get ready. Something big's coming to LA. Meanwhile, you've got Darvin Ham, who is kind of becoming sort of the embodiment of the dog on fire meme, where he's like, ah, we can't wait to get Russ. Meanwhile, trade rumors circling all around him, and Darvin Ham is on like the Summer League TV broadcast being like, we can't wait to get Russ into training camp. I can't wait to coach Russell Westbrook, doing his duty as head coach. What else is he going to say? But Howard, like, I don't know how much you read into that, you know, the lack of interaction between LeBron and Russell Westbrook at a Summer League game, but it certainly raised some eyebrows from the people that were there. That those two did not interact on the floor. And does it make it even more likely that the Lakers do whatever it takes to get Russell Westbrook off the roster before training camp starts in September?
So, look, I've already taken certain things as a given. I know I shouldn't. We should assume nothing. It's a given they're trading Russell Westbrook in a deal for Kyrie Irving. It just is. It's going to happen. It's not going to be a two-way trade because the Nets have no use for Russell Westbrook. And he'd be a terrible, 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 terrible fit next to Ben Simmons, assuming Ben Simmons is still there himself. This is inevitable. There's only one team that really wants Kyrie Irving, and it's the Lakers. LeBron James wants Kyrie Irving, so LeBron James is going to get Kyrie Irving. The Nets want to trade Kyrie Irving, so they're going to do it. And like that's it. Like there are other conceivable outcomes. There are no other logical outcomes. There's nothing else that I'm really like. If we wake up in the middle of August and Kyrie Irving is on the Grizzlies and Westbrook is, you know, in Portland or something, then I'll say, wow, I really got this wrong back in July. But Westbrook and Kyrie are going to be involved in a trade, not directly for each other, because Westbrook needs to land somewhere else for the Nets' sake. Or maybe they're induced by picks enough to do it and then buy him out or something. But that doesn't seem like the way that they want to go, because they need players for this coming season. They're trying to stay competitive. So I just take it as a given, Chris. And the fact that Westbrook and LeBron have this weird moment or this day in the gym where they're sitting on opposite sides of the court and people are observing LeBron dapping up and hugging everybody else in the building except for Westbrook, and they never interact. There are times we all overdo this. Everybody's snapping their photos. Everybody's like, ooh, putting it on Twitter. Look, ooh, this guy's here, this guy's there. Look at what they're doing, what they're not doing. Sometimes it's a little out of control. It's a little bit freaking third grade. But it's notable when two stars of that caliber who play on the same team, and because there's this cloud over the whole thing, when they don't interact, I don't think we're overreacting in this case. And so I think that just underscores the reality of what I was just saying. That this is inevitable. It's coming. We don't know which day it's coming. We don't know what the ultimate deal will be or how many teams are involved, but it's coming.
Yeah, I think it's coming too, and I do think there is going to have to be a third team involved, because I don't, you know, we've talked about this before, but the Nets, as much as they would love to get a draft pick out of the Lakers, they do want to stay competitive. They have no reason to tank, and just removing Kyrie Irving off the roster for nothing tangible back in return, at least not short term, doesn't make a lot of sense for them at the moment. There was some buzz I was picking up on about Charlotte, no pun intended, being involved in a Westbrook deal. You know, Westbrook, don't know if he, well, look, he's represented by the Jordan brand, Michael Jordan, the owner of the Charlotte Hornets. You know, could he fit in for 1 year with Charlotte? Charlotte's been trying to move off some long-term contracts. Gordon Hayward for one, maybe Terry Rozier as well. Their situation, though, has gotten more complicated with Miles Bridges and everything going on off the court involving him accused of domestic violence. You know, that was a guy set to make near max money with Charlotte. I don't know if he's going to be in the NBA next year. So that's certainly a variable. We're not sure how that's going to account for. But I could see, and there are teams and player teams and executives I talked to could see a three-team deal emerging with Westbrook going to Charlotte with perhaps some draft capital. Maybe it's a first-round pick as a sweetener. Some combination of Gordon Hayward, Terry Rozier, something like that going to Brooklyn. And look, that Rozier and Hayward or one or both would probably make the Nets better. Rozier certainly could plug into that point guard spot. He's got playoff experience from his time in Boston, successful playoff experience at that. So like I could see something like that developing, but I don't think it's a two-team deal. I don't.
Wouldn't be the first time that Rozier replaced Kyrie and did better than Kyrie did.
Hey, he's become very good at that on some level. But
just a quick observation there.
Yeah, I just don't think it's going to be a two-team deal. There's a lot of reasons, but I don't think that draft capital just is not enough of a sweetener, I think, for the Nets to want to get on board with that.
Right, and also because they don't need or want Westbrook. And you know, plus his contract is so huge, you're going to need a third team, fourth team, fifth team. Who knows? This could be a massive deal ultimately. But the problem is, I don't see where Westbrook really fits. Like, I don't like what Westbrook fit with LaMelo in Charlotte.
No,
I mean, and this is the other part of this, right? Like, we could make a case for certain teams taking a chance on Kyrie, who brings baggage with him, but he's an easy fit basketball wise because of his skill set. If you think you can rely on him and you're willing to take the chance, okay, fine. Westbrook is harder. It's a lot harder to find the right spot for Westbrook right now. And I don't think Charlotte is it. I don't think Brooklyn is it. It's not going to be back to Washington. It's not going to be back to Houston. It's not the Lakers. Like, we're going to run out of teams eventually. And it's not the Blazers because they've just re-signed Lillard. It's, you know, or signed Lillard to an extension. It's not like I don't know where Westbrook should land. You know, people's favorite spot for a while was the Knicks because, well, the Knicks have a habit of doing this, right? Well, they didn't. And they just signed Jalen Brunson. Yep. And they're probably holding out hope of still making a deal for Donovan Mitchell. So the problem in even saying, oh, sure, of course, they'll just make it a multi-team deal and Westbrook will go somewhere else. Where? That's the difficulty. Yeah.
No, that's why I think if he got traded somewhere else, even if it is Charlotte, which again, the Jordan-Westbrook relationship has to be factored into that equation, there's a pretty good chance he just gets waived or you know, certainly they'd have buyout negotiations, but maybe waived outright. And the appeal is the draft pick you get back in return. So the Hornets would get some salary cap relief in the long term, and they get a draft pick to deal with the short-term pain they get from taking on that contract. But I agree with you. I can't think of a single team that makes obvious sense for Russell Westbrook. We've discussed this in the past. There's a chance that Westbrook has played his last NBA game, which is bizarre to think of at this point. But I don't know where he would land. Like, I also don't know that Westbrook is, like, you know, going to go into a situation and be like, listen, I'll be the backup. I'm cool with that. I'm good. Like, he's resisted that for a long period of time. Maybe getting waived is humbling, and maybe, you know, a team out there, you know, buys into Russell Westbrook as sixth man, which I think he still could be at a high level in the NBA. But I don't know. I don't know who that team is right now.
I don't either.
It's a lot to examine. We'll have to do that again on the next podcast. Howard, you enjoy Las Vegas. I'm glad to be out of there, and I will see Vegas. Actually, I was going to say see it next year, but given my boxing schedule, I'll see it in 2 months when I'm at the Canelo-Golovkin fight. So see you soon, Vegas, and see you soon, Howard Beck.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.